You may proceed.
Thank you. To please the court and counsel, I'm John Scorsese. I'm an attorney down in Colorado Springs, and I'm here today representing SH Logistics, who is the appellant in this matter. My bar number is 37131. This is a case that arised out of the Division of Unemployment Insurance through their audit process and was heard by the Industrial Appeals Council, as the court's well aware. And it comes on the heels of the Supreme Court decisions last May in Western Logistics and the Soft Rock case. And it basically deals with a business model that is prevalent in the transportation industry. And perhaps that's why this case is truly important. This case deals with the owner-operator business model in our transportation sector of our economy. SH Logistics is not very different than many other small business operators who engage in this owner-operator model of transportation. I believe that the primary issues for the court to address here, when we reduce this down to its simplest form, is really how three cases and two statutes get interpreted and get applied to the facts in this case. Those three cases, the Soft Rock decision and the Western decision, which recently came out last May from our Supreme Court, and this court's previous decision in SZL that came out, I believe it was in 2011. Those three cases overarch the two statutes in question. One, which is found at Title 8, the 8-7115, which you typically hear about when we're talking about independent contractor versus employee type determinations by the department. And 40-11.5-102, which is a specific statute that was designed and addressed, as this court identified in the SCL case, to deal with the owner-operator business model. This is that case that I think the Court of Appeals was hinting would be off in the winds at some point in time back in 2011. This is a case where we have to determine what is the appropriate analytical framework to decide whether these owner-operators are employees or independent contractors, whether it's under Title 8 or under Title 40. And that becomes a question, in my mind, of standard statutory construction. Do we apply the specific over the general? There's a specific statute that speaks about the owner-operator relationship.
Did you meet the requirements of that statute?
We believe we did. The department says we didn't. And that has been an evolutionary issue in the analysis. The hearing examiner initially said, for example, that we didn't even meet the threshold of that 102 statute, stating, for example, that there was, in fact, an owner-operator leaseback of equipment type relationship. And in the decision that came from the panel, they said, no, it's clear. The beginning of the contract outlines exactly what this relationship is. And they said, this meets that first hurdle. And then we looked at, then the panel looked at the next, I believe, seven criteria that come in the next sub-portion of that Title 40 statute.
Do you agree that you have to meet all seven? In other words, that if you don't meet all seven, you're done, and then you just go under the regular Article 8 test?
No, I don't. I believe that the statute says that you have to meet these seven, and if you do, then a presumption shall arise. But I don't believe it means that that is the only way a presumption can arise. I think if you take a look at the totality of the circumstances, which was imposed upon us in the Supreme Court decision in Soft Rock, and apply it to this set of situations, we're not looking for a checklist form any longer, but rather what we're looking at is what is the actual business relationship between the parties? And when you look at that totality of the circumstances here, it is clear that the relevant factors that make this an owner-operator type business and the facts themselves lead to that inescapable conclusion.
Just so I understand which side we're on here, do you agree that you did not satisfy all seven? I understand your argument that even when you don't, you still can establish this presumption, but do you agree that you did not meet each of the seven statutory factors?
I think there's only one which one could argue that we didn't meet in its entirety, and that concerns radio communication. And in the case of this business, there was testimony during the hearing that indicated that we use telephones, we call in. There wasn't a radio communication network. And when you look at those seven criteria, really and truly, what the legislature's intent was to do was to take those instruments of control that would normally say, absolutely, you are an employee. Somebody has a radio on you and they can reach out and touch you. What those seven criteria really did was take those things and set them aside and say, even though you may have radio communication, it's going to be an independent contractor relationship. But, yes, Your Honor.
No, I was just okay. I was just agreeing with what you just said.
Okay. So I think that's really the intent of the legislature. The only way you can look at this case is look at what was the intent of the legislature in developing that provision in Title 40.
But the problem I have with that is that even if I agree with you that this seems to have it all backwards, because these are all factors that would say it would be an employment relationship. So it's strange. But the legislature does strange things sometimes. And unless it's really, really, really strange, don't we have to follow what the legislature says?
Absolutely. But I think the court points out that when things are really absurd, as they are in this case, and I think that's the language out of one of this court's decisions, when the interpretation becomes one of absurdity, okay, we need to take a look at what was the true intent of the legislature. And there can be little question here that the true intent of the legislature was to allow for this portion of our economy in the transportation sector to be a business model. So,
well, if you meet the criteria of the statute.
And I think the largest criteria of the statute is that first criteria in subpart A that sits there and says, do you or do you not have an owner-operator type criteria? When we get into some of the absurdities of the statute, we get led down a rabbit hole of what is a motor carrier and what is a common carrier and how those get interpreted.
But clearly you don't fit under 1A1 because you're not working with a certificated the independent contractor is not working with a certificated taxi or limousine carrier.
Right. You're working under the second portion of that first part. You're a common carrier and
you're
a
saying
company.
That the definition that is in, now I can't remember which article, is not applicable. You'd rather go with Black's Law Dictionary or definitions.
I think it becomes a bit absurd when we sit there and say a trucking company is only a common carrier if it hauls or tows vehicles, hauls people, or I think there was a third item.
But that's what the statute says.
I think the statute's not all inclusive. That would mean to say that every truck running down I-25 today that's hauling furniture, that has an ICC permit on its door, is somehow not a common carrier. That would seem to say that every vehicle hauling groceries to Safeway, every 18-wheeler on Highway 70 is not a common carrier. That's an absurd result.
Why is it absurd? Why couldn't the legislature say, we want to make an exemption when we're talking about moving people, but not so much for goods? Why is that irrational? Why is that absurd?
I think it's absurd because it flies in the face of the conventions of how we structure the transportation industry nationwide. This vehicle is required to be, as it's engaged in interstate commerce, a licensed common carrier. It's required to have an ICC permit. It's required to engage in that business in accordance with federal rules, laws, and regulations.
By the way, counsel, I meant to tell you, you may reserve time for rebuttal if you'd like.
I know, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Did you make the argument below that you can still get the presumption even if you don't meet all seven of the statutory factors?
I did mention that in the memorandum that we delivered to the appeals panel.
But not to the ALJ?
We did not mention it to the ALJ at that time. We were dealing with just where we were sitting at that point in time and trying to get through this. The ALJ wouldn't even recognize, if you look at the transcript, would hardly even tolerate us raising the issue of Title 40. In fact, as soon as we submitted a trial memorandum, we received back a litany from the department that we were totally wrong, that Title 40 had absolutely no implications or role to play in this determination. And as throughout the hearing, whenever we would try to raise the Title 40 issues, we were pretty well shut down. And in her opinion, the hearing examiner only briefly mentioned whether or not Title 40 was there and basically said Title 40 didn't apply anywhere, and even if it did, we didn't have any provisions of Section 102 satisfied, whereas the panel saw it otherwise and basically said that there were three that they felt we didn't satisfy. And our argument is that there's only one. If I can reserve the last 3 minutes.
You may.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Krista Mayer, registration number 42140 from the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. The Industrial Claim Appeals Panel in this case concluded that six truck drivers working for SH Logistics were employees. The panel's order should be affirmed for two reasons, which I will discuss in further detail. First, the panel correctly determined that SH Logistics, also known as SHL, or I'll refer to them also as SHL, was liable for unemployment insurance premiums because its drivers were not customarily engaged in independent businesses and therefore were employees under the Colorado Employment Security Act. Second, Section 4011.5-102 does not present a conflict with that determination.
Isn't that kind of putting it backwards? In other words, if the Title 40 presumption applies, then you don't apply, at least as you normally would apply, the Title 8 test. It just seemed to me that they got that exactly reversed, and you seem to perpetuate that.
And it is a different, we took a different order than the appellant took in our brief. And I'm taking that order now because we believe that when determining unemployment liability for unemployment insurance premiums, that the first stop is 870.115, and that is always the key to determining whether an employer is liable for unemployment insurance.
Isn't that just contrary to SZL?
And Your Honor, I mean, I think that we could look at it both ways. And so I did choose to take a certain order in presenting my arguments, but I do think that we could look at it either way. We could look at 4011.5102 as a threshold barrier to determine whether whether there is a presumption under that statute first. And either way, I think that the panel got it right in this case. The presumption provided in 40.11.5.102 subsection 4 doesn't apply here because, as SHL has conceded at least one of the statutory provisions was missing from the lease, and the panel also concluded, even though it gave a generous reading to the lease at issue, it still determined that two other provisions were also missing from the lease.
Isn't it kind of crazy, I'll use the word irrational, for the legislature to say, you have to put in something in here about radio communications when the particular trucking company doesn't use radio communications? Isn't that virtually irrational? And then to condition this presumption that would otherwise arise of independent contractor status upon putting in this crazy provision?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it irrational. I think if we look at the statute, there is an allowance for both motor carriers who use radio telecommunications and motor carriers who don't. I think that the statute can allow a lease to include a provision that discusses radio telecommunications without necessarily requiring the company to come up with regulations.
So you would meet that factor of the Title 40 test if you put in there, we don't use radio communications, therefore we provide no provisions with respect to radio communications. Is that what you're saying?
Well, and it's a little bit of a difficult issue to answer just because it wasn't the factual issue of whether this company actually used radio telecommunications wasn't presented below. There's that first issue, that factual issue, an evidentiary issue. Whether we can assume that under circumstances where that issue was discussed in evidence below, whether you can then argue about how the law applies to it. It's a little bit difficult for me to answer, and I'd be happy to provide supplemental briefing on that particular issue. But I think that there's room in the statute for a company to address that without actually having radio telecommunications.
Council, what other requirements of the what I'll call the presumption statute do you contend the evidence shows were not included within the agreements here?
Well, there was no provision for under Section 40.11.5.102.1e regarding periodic driver safety training. There was testimony that the carrier did provide periodic safety training to its employees, but there was no such provision in the lease. There was also not a provision for the establishment of specific number of hours in which to complete a particular shipment of goods and the creation of shifts in order to meet public need.
Do you agree that normally these factors that the statute appears to require be in the lease in order to establish independent contractor status, do you agree that it seems to be kind of backwards in the sense that these are normally factors that would militate in favor of employment status?
I don't think all of them do. This is an issue that I struggled with a little bit, and I would agree that it seems a little bit counterintuitive to have this exclusivity provision, for example, when it seems to be counter to our rules in determining whether a person is an independent contractor or an employee. However, I think that's counterintuitive because we're talking about unemployment insurance premiums, and which is under a different statute and under a different set of public concerns than those addressed in the motor carrier statute.
Could it be that the purpose of the statute was to say, we'll give you this break, but only if you have a lease which requires that you do certain things to make sure people are performing or are getting the supervision that they need, but we'll nonetheless give you the break?
Absolutely. addressing SHL's argument.
Do you agree that you need to have, Mr. Scorsese says you don't have to meet all seven of them in order to get some type of a presumption, if I'm misstating, and I think that's what he's saying. Do you agree with that?
No. I know that SHL has presented an argument that SoftRock's totality of the circumstances approach in the unemployment insurance context should apply in this motor carrier statute as well. However, the statutes are different. 871.15 provides us with a two-part test, but doesn't provide a bright line test for us to make the determination under that statute. And so, as the court is well aware, there have been a series of cases trying to interpret that statute leading up to SoftRock and Western Logistics. Subsection 4 of 40.11.5.102, on the other hand, does have a very clear set of requirements. It simply lists the provisions in the statute that must appear in a lease in order to create the independent contractor presumption. Now, going back to the exclusivity issue, there's an argument presented by SHL that 49 CFR section 376.12C1 requires exclusivity. However, that's, I don't read it the same way that SHL reads it. It does not require that a lease contain a provision requiring a driver to work exclusively for the carrier. Instead, the language of that regulation requires that such a lease must provide that the carrier lessee shall have exclusive possession, control, and use of the equipment for the duration of the lease. That is the leased equipment under the lease. Additionally, as noted in SCL, 49 CFR section 376.12C4 expressly provides that nothing in the provisions under subsection C1 should affect the determination of whether a worker is an independent contractor or an employee. So going back to 871.15, under SoftRock's guidance, the court, and I'll note also upon SHL's request, the panel reconsidered its order. SHL did send a letter to, I meant the panel. SHL did send a letter to the panel asking the panel to reconsider its order in light of the SoftRock and Western Logistics cases. And that's at pages 312 and 313 in the record. And so they did. And under SoftRock's guidance, they looked at all of the relevant factors, including those provided in 870.115, and other relevant factors, including those discussed in the case Longview. They determined that at least four of the statutory factors were in favor of finding that the drivers were employees. Those included the fact that the workers were required to work exclusively for the carrier, the testimony that the drivers or SHL could terminate the relationship at any time, the fact that SHL did provide more than minimal training to the drivers, and the fact that SHL paid the workers individually in their own names rather than to independent businesses.
Ms. Mayor, if the presumption arises under Title 40, what's the remaining inquiry after that? What happens then in order to make a final determination whether these people are independent contractors or employees?
Well, pursuant to that section, if the presumption applied, and SDL did address that and did conclude that if all of those provisions were met, then the presumption could apply in the unemployment context. At that point, the next step would be that the presumption could be overcome by clear and convincing evidence under the statute. The panel here did not consider that argument because it determined that the presumption did not apply here. And so it moved directly to 870.115.
In other words, the division would then have the burden of overcoming it by presenting the other factors.
And that's how I read that, Your Honor, is that that's how I read the SCL case, was that the effect would be to shift the burden from the employer back to the division. Briefly, I just want to quickly address that the transcript below shows absolutely no evidence or indication of bias against SHL. I disagree my reading with opposing counsel's reading of the transcript, because I feel that the transcript showed that the hearing officer provided SHL with every opportunity to present evidence, to present argument, to cross-examine, that it provided to the division. So I'll just briefly address that. And then I know that this is a little bit of a sticky statutory issue, so I just want to invite any other questions that the division might have. Okay, well, if there are no further questions, then I would ask that for the foregoing reasons, this court affirm the panel's order. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Scorsese.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, it's our position on these two different checklists, if you will. The checklist we find in Title 40 of the seven factors, that we did satisfy all of them except the radio communication requirement. And in that case, it wasn't addressed because it doesn't exist. We believe that the training was covered in paragraph 12 of the contract, which talks about the requirements of the ICC for the transportation company to ensure the training and periodic testing, training, and those regulations of their driving force.
Is Ms. Mayer right that there isn't anything in the record that would allow a finding that your client did not use radio communications?
The record at the hearing said the question was specifically asked, how do you communicate with SHL? And the only response was, well, the only way we communicate is by telephone calls. The second area is hours. And this is a general contract. Nobody knows what loads, what shipments, what parameters someone is going to have to haul these commodities. You could be a trucker who picks up a load in Denver that goes to Cheyenne, or a trucker that picks up a load in Denver that has to go to Bangor, Maine. So to expect that there would be a specific timeline and hours within the contract is a bit ridiculous from that perspective. What is in the contract is that these drivers will pick up and have the option of taking the task orders, and those task orders say this produce has to be in Bangor, Maine by Wednesday at noon. And that's how we get to those hour requirements. Also through the incorporation of the ICC regulations that provide hours of operation and other requirements that these truckers have to maintain in order to be operating lawfully on our highways. Lastly, when we go, even if we didn't satisfy Title 40's checklist, which of course SoftRock frowns upon the checklist concept, we believe that we satisfy the totality of the circumstances in Title 8. On page 9 of the panel's decision, they go through basically seven items that they say lends towards an independent contractor, and then two factors that they say lends towards them being employees. And I'd simply ask, as my time is running out, that the court find in favor of SHL.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and we will be rendering a decision in due course.